from KUT and KUTX Studios.
This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of 2018. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Some of our favorite stories of the year, including why some undocumented parents could have to choose between a green card and services for their U.S.-born kids.
What we're seeing the most with our families is a paralysis.
How a sudden setback can lead to an eviction in Travis County.
Starting as soon as the second, the landlord usually then has the right to give them what's called a notice to vacate.
And a tiny Austin cemetery that's been here for 162 years.
At this point, I would assume it'll be left there for some time to come.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. I probably don't need to tell you, news consumer, smart person, that 2018 was a pretty eventful year in Austin, across the country, around the world, really. But here we had a series of bombings in the spring that killed two people and seriously injured four others. A few months later, a school shooting outside Houston in Santa Fe ISD prompted Governor Greg Abbott to convene a series of roundtable discussions and issue this school safety plan. This year, the Trump administration announced its so-called zero tolerance policy, which led to family separations at the southwest border. The White House backtracked after a national outcry, but the issue of immigration never really left center stage. In Austin, we awaited word from Amazon about its HQ2 and word from City Council about a Major League Soccer stadium. Dockless scooters arrived to the city. Code Next was scrapped. A scorching hot summer gave way to a rainy fall and led to historic flooding in the Hill Country. And then we had that murky water overwhelming Austin's water treatment plants, prompting a week-long notice to boil water. A record number of Travis County residents registered to vote. We had an election. Oh, yeah, forgot about that. And it was one in which Senator Ted Cruz faced a pretty serious challenge from Congressman Beto O'Rourke. And a lot more than that happened. So here are the stories that KUT reporters felt passionate about in 2018. Each reporter picked their own story as their favorite to report and produce. I did not choose these. But let's start with this one by KUT's Ashley Lopez. It's about a growing number of American children foregoing services such as Medicaid, even food stamps in the U.S. because their parents are undocumented. It's a problem that's been concerning public health experts in Texas for a while now. And as Ashley tells us, there's even more concern following a proposed Trump administration immigration policy.
In a former elementary school in East Austin, Maria Hernandez is teaching a room full of slightly uncomfortable parents how to power pose.
Megan, I saw you get excited, Megan. You're like, yeah, let's do some power posing.
Some parents make a big X with their bodies, arms in the air. Others strike a Wonder Woman pose, fist to their hips. The point of this exercise is to teach these parents how to feel confident before they go into meetings where they will have to advocate for their kids. This class is put together by a group called Vela, which Hernandez says exclusively helps parents whose children have disabilities.
But we focus on the caregiver. So we offer free courses and support groups to really empower that parent to navigate the disability journey.
Vela is based in East Austin, but Hernandez says she sees parents from 55 different zip codes in the area.
Of all of those families, about 70% are immigrant families, mostly from Mexico. And so we're working with families the parents are immigrant, but the children are born here.
And Hernandez says families in this situation are having an especially hard time lately getting access to healthcare services for their children, who again are U.S. citizens. She works with families who have been relying on Medicaid for years because their child has a long-term disability.
And then in the last 6 months, they've already gotten requests for additional proof of eligibility. And so any of those additional requests, or we'd like you to submit extra paychecks, or just to show that you're eligible, already put parents in a place where they say, this feels scary, this feels new, and so what I'm going to do is withdraw.
And this is the exact situation that Marlene finds herself in. We're not using her last name because she's undocumented. She has two children, both are U.S. citizens. Her son has speech and learning disabilities, which is why he's on Medicaid. But for Marlene, his enrollment in Medicaid is becoming an issue for her.
Porque te están haciendo unas preguntas indagando de tu vida hasta de pies a cabeza.
She says the government is asking a lot of questions right now, investigating her life from, quote, head to toe. In fact, she says she stopped applying for her family to get food stamps because the application asked for things she never had to provide before, including years of pay stubs.
Porque me pidieron muchas, muchas cosas que no, antes no me pedían. Y para mí fue muy estresante que llegué a enfermarme de estrés y de miedo.
Marlene says foregoing food stamps is better than getting sick from stress and fear. For now, her son has another year of Medicaid, which is a big relief. But she doesn't know what will happen when she reapplies.
No sé qué va a pasar para el otro año. No sé qué me van a pedir.
And soon those services her American son is relying on could become another liability for Marlene. The Trump administration is proposing a change to the criteria for immigrants who are trying to enter the U.S. or immigrants who are already here and want to become legal permanent residents. Ann Dunkelberg is with an Austin-based think tank called the Center for Public Policy Priorities. She says that would be a big change.
Currently, the only thing that gets held against you, as it were, is if you're likely to be permanently, completely dependent on the government for your support.
She says that test of whether someone will be completely dependent on the government, which is known as a public charge, applies to people who would need to be in a hospital or nursing homes long term, among other things. But the Trump administration wants to radically change what a public charge means. They're considering adding a whole bunch of things that could count against someone immigrating here. That includes food stamps, Medicaid, food programs for new mothers, CHIP, health insurance subsidies, and even an earned income tax credit.
So not only would they potentially hold all these new things that they used to vehemently not hold against people, but they are also going to hold against the potential immigrant if any of their immediate family members use any of these benefits. And that completely includes any and all family members who are U.S. citizens and who may be using those benefits completely appropriately and legally.
And that means families will have to choose between A, getting help for their American children and possibly foregoing a legal status, and B, not getting any help at all and staying in the shadows.
Whether this is intentional or not, it has the effect of downgrading the value of citizenship of those citizen family members. So it's basically saying, well, yeah, you're a U.S. citizen, but you don't have the same rights and privileges as a U.S. citizen child.
Back in East Austin, Maria Hernandez says this could exacerbate a situation that started with Senate Bill 4. That's the law passed in Texas last year that requires local law enforcement to cooperate with federal immigration authorities.
What we're seeing the most with our families is a paralysis. So where they are coming off of SB 4, there was already such a withdrawal or a reduced access to services. And so recently, in the last 2 months, we've seen that families that have to renew Medicaid are just saying that they are not going to, out of fear, and so that they're just going to rely on emergency room visits as needed.
Hernandez says that means a lot of kids with disabilities who have made progress will likely start backsliding. And it's something parents like Marlene wish they could avoid. But she says she and other parents are withdrawing from services their children are legally entitled to for their kids.
No soy la única persona que está renunciando a cosas. No para mí, para mis hijos, que es por ley les corresponde a ellos.
This proposed policy is still under review by the White House. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
Our biggest story of the year was probably the series of bombings in the spring that killed two people and seriously injured four others. Here's a 3-minute reminder of what it was like to live through.
I know you all will ask whether this is terrorism related. Again, there is no information that we have right now to believe this is anything other than an isolated incident, but we're working diligently to understand this incident.
I remember Stefan being just quiet most of the time. It was always a no small talk type conversation with him. I like that about him.
Police had believed a package bomb that killed a 39-year-old man in Austin on March 2nd was an isolated incident. But now there are two more bombings under nearly identical circumstances.
The 17-year-old boy that was murdered has been identified as Draylen Mason. And from everything I've heard about Draylen, he was an outstanding young man.
That is heartbreaking. Innocent people. We don't know what's going on or why somebody would do that.
We are not ruling out terrorism. We're not ruling out hate.
What really made me the most upset, besides obviously the loss of life, was that it might be racially motivated. That's what made me feel sick.
I don't think the community is responding in a way of fear. It's just about what can we do and how can we come together to either prevent these things from happening or be there for each other.
Police received a call around 8:30 Sunday evening about an explosion in the Travis Country neighborhood.
Is this terrorism? Is this hate related? That is something that we're going to analyze. We are clearly dealing with what we expect to be a serial bomber.
The use of the tripwire and the device yesterday, it changes it from a more of a targeted approach to a more random approach.
What we've done now is we start to write down what day packages are supposed to arrive and when.
Shirts police responded to a call for a blast at the FedEx distribution facility.
A package had been traveling along the automated conveyor when it had exploded.
The FBI confirmed that there were, in fact, two suspicious packages found in FedEx facilities.
As I understand, the last one, the mailed package, I think will lead to more evidence. Hopefully fingerprints and surveillance photos.
And then after he was seen and his vehicle was seen on the cameras at the FedEx office, within hours, they pieced all of this information together.
As members of the Austin Police Department SWAT team approached the vehicle, the suspect detonated a bomb inside the vehicle.
You literally had Austin police officers running towards a vehicle that had an explosive device in it that detonated. That is unbelievable courage.
This is really good news that we have now. But yes, the investigation is continuing.
What I can tell you, having listened to that recording, he does not at all mention anything about terrorism.
You know, that's a terrorist. Like someone who's changing people's lives for the worse and then, you know, making them feel terrorized.
Even though the words are enormously similar, there's a vast difference between being terrorized and what terrorism is. The act of violence has to be placed within a larger context of some political movement or of a broader ideological framework.
He did refer to himself as a psychopath. He did not show any remorse. In fact, questioning himself as to why he didn't feel remorse for what he did. And it's hard to imagine someone whose mind is so sick.
To be clear, the suspect in this incident rained terror on our community for almost 3 weeks. This investigation continues. We will identify, if possible, any motive.
For many residents of color in Austin, the bombings across the city amplified racial tensions and a fear of racist attacks. Investigators said a recorded confession that was left by the bomber did not identify race as his motive. But as KUT's Saida Hassan reported, the attacks left many communities of color feeling targeted.
In the days after the Austin bombings, Jesus Valles couldn't stop his thoughts from buzzing around like bees in his head.
Austin is an exhausting place where racism smiles at you and does yoga and is a kind teacher and is such a good actor and is just trying to help you and just wants to know why you're so upset and thinks we should wait to know.
Valles made sense of his feelings the best way he knew how. He sat down at his computer and began to write this public Facebook post about Austin.
And it is asking you to smile all the time, and it shops at Whole Foods and it loves trap, and if you don't like it here and if this city is such a problem, then why don't you just leave? And it is so exhausting, 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 and it is so exhausting.
Valles is a teacher by day. He's also a writer and a performer. His Facebook post has been liked by more than 8,000 users and shared by more than 4,000. The comments are filled with people saying things like, "You could be describing my city," or "I'm so sorry you feel this way." Valles says he's also been getting hateful responses from white supremacists. He says he was expecting that. But more than anything, his words have touched on certain truths for many Austin residents of color.
What's been fascinating is that the people who have been most viscerally responsive to it in a negative way have almost entirely been people who I think would see themselves as left-leaning or liberal. And I think it's because the idea is that a specific political orientation absolves you from racism, and that is not the case.
When we talk about Austin, there's a sort of shorthand that gets used a lot. It's weird. It's a progressive city. It's a blueberry in a sea of tomato soup. But Baez's words give shape to a sort of alternate reality that exists for many residents of color, and it made some people angry. There have been moments over the past month that have highlighted this racial divide. The first package bomb exploded on March 2nd, killing 39-year-old Anthony Stefan House, an African-American man. At the time, police were working with a theory that the attack was related to a drug raid they'd conducted at a house down the street. They also questioned whether House may have been in some way responsible for his own death, an idea that offended many residents of color. Austin Interim Police Chief Brian Manley later offered an explanation for those statements.
What we had was a singular event that had taken place in this community that was very unique. We had no information to believe that it was related to a larger plan at that time.
The first three package bombings all took place east of I-35, injuring and killing people of color. The attacker's approach changed with the fourth bombing. This one didn't appear to have a specific target. It was set off by a tripwire in a residential neighborhood in southwest Austin. The explosion injured two white men. Two more package bombs were shipped through FedEx facilities. Some observers took that change to say, look, these attacks aren't racist, they're random.
There's a sense that this really isn't part of who we are. This isn't really part of our history. And that comes across at times as a disavowal of history or a kind of evasion of historical truth.
Eric Tang is an associate professor of African American and Asian American studies at UT Austin. For years, Tang has been studying why many African American residents are leaving Austin, either by choice or because of financial pressures. He also looked at why some East Austin residents have chosen to stay.
And they stayed because they were resilient and they want to continue to hold on to that sense of community, despite having been segregated there to begin with, followed by rapid displacement of their communities owing to gentrification. And what they feel is that very few people in this city acknowledge that history. So this is the context, right, in which three package bombs go off in East Austin.
Tang says we shouldn't ignore why the attacks have felt like terror for many people of color.
For those who have more than just a passing sense of U.S. history, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear a bomb has gone off in a southern city? The first four victims were all people of color. Again, if you have more than a passing knowledge of U.S. history, you understand that this resonates with a history of racial terror.
And that feeling of terror didn't dissipate when the confessed bomber killed himself or when authorities said his recorded confession didn't identify race as a motive. About 20 miles north of downtown Austin, I met Sheldon Lamey in his neighborhood in Pflugerville. The 41-year-old is the president of Pflugerville Black Business Builders. Lamey was born and raised in Austin. He moved to Pflugerville about 11 years ago, drawn in part by a lower cost of living. Lamey also appreciates the community he's found in Pflugerville.
Better schools and also more black businesses I can patronize out here too as well. Don't get me wrong, I patronize all businesses, but I'm just saying just more community involvement, more cultural awareness and everything out here in Pflugerville.
In the wake of the bombings, Lamey says people feel unnerved, especially after learning the attacker lived in Pflugerville. He says the language used to talk about these attacks, in particular not officially labeling the bomber a terrorist, has been frustrating.
When you terrorize the whole city, there's no other word but to call terrorist, because everybody was scared. They, you know, I had one friend that said that her son was scared to go to school because he was scared that maybe a package bomb might show up to the school and everything. That was here in Pflugerville. So it was a terrorist act.
Lamey says he and other residents are trying to focus on keeping their community safe. They're banding together neighborhood watch groups and holding self-defense classes.
We can't take it for granted that this won't happen again. So we got to be proactive instead of reactive.
In central East Austin, Jane Rivera and her husband Gilbert have been trying to process some of the same feelings.
It appeared that these were very personal attacks directed to people's homes in communities of color. We're very outspoken in support of the community. Who knows, we might be next. And that's how all of us were feeling, very threatened.
The Riveras have owned their home in the Rosewood neighborhood since the 1980s. Gilbert Rivera is president of the local neighborhood association. He says the bombings no longer dominate their conversations, but the attacks have heightened another kind of pressure that's a constant part of their life in Austin.
Every single day, we get phone calls, we get letters in the mail, we get people knocking on our doors, telling us it is time for us to move out.
Rivera says having a bomber appear to target his community adds to the feeling of not being welcome in Austin. These days, he keeps coming back to the same question. Where will he go if he has to leave? Saida Hassan, KUT News.
Austin is a city of renters. 55% of households in this city rent. The numbers are only slightly lower for Travis County as a whole. And that got KUT's Audrey McGlinchey wondering, how common are evictions here? Well, what she found out surprised her. On average, 12 Travis County families a day are evicted from their homes.
Eviction court is probably the last place anyone wants to be. People sit in wooden chairs or in pews, depending which of five courthouses they're in. There's a family with three kids, an elderly couple, a formerly homeless teenager. None of these people can pay their rent. That's the majority of eviction cases. Let's think about that for a second. Landlords don't typically rent an apartment to someone who can't afford it. That's just not sound business. Evictions you see are stories of crises. The people in this courtroom work at call centers and pizza shops. They earn $8.50 an hour. They have little to no savings. And so, when they lose a job or a roommate leaves without notice, they end up here, in eviction court.
All rise. This is court 5-9 session. The judge 2 presiding.
The judge walks in and starts calling the cases, usually some LLC versus a tenant.
I'm next. That's all I could think.
This is civil court, so lawyers are rare for both the tenant and the landlord. Typically, a property manager sits at one table in front of the judge, the renter at another.
I didn't think I'd have a chance. I just thought we were going to be next.
Judges ask landlords for the bill. How much does the tenant owe? Then they look to the other table.
What's going on? How did we get to this point?
They listen intently, and they're sympathetic, and sometimes their bailiffs hand out tissues. But at the end of the day, the law doesn't have space for the crisis in this renter's life. And a landlord has bills to pay. In 2017, roughly half of all these cases filed in Travis County courts resulted in evictions.
I just knew that he was going to say, I'm sorry, but I have to rule with the plaintiff. And those words kind of just played over and over and over in my head.
And when that happens, a tenant has 5 days to move out.
Can we just kind of go through the steps of, you know, how this all happens?
Certainly. So with an eviction, somebody defaults under their lease.
This is Corey Rogers. He's a real estate lawyer.
Let's go with non-payment.
Rent's due on the first of the month.
Starting as soon as the second, the landlord usually then has the right to give them what's called a notice to vacate.
Tenants' advocates tell me this is when most people leave. Having an eviction filed against you in court, however it turns out, is not good. Landlords have access to this information, and so even a filing against you can make it hard to rent again. With a notice to vacate, you have 3 days to move.
If the tenant doesn't move out, then the landlord is eligible to file an eviction.
Which makes this all official. You get a court date, and 2 weeks later, you're in front of a judge, with the landlord telling their side,
you know, look, here's the lease. They were supposed to pay this amount of rent. They didn't. I gave them a notice to vacate on this day. They didn't vacate. I'd like a judgment for possession of the property.
And the tenant telling theirs, Last year, there were more than 4,400 evictions in Travis County. We're on track to surpass that number this year. Eviction filings have been steadily rising, except for a small dip, for the past 4 years. No one really knows exactly why. Population increases don't really explain it. But here's some ideas I've heard. Wages not keeping up with rising housing costs, low vacancy rates so a landlord can find a new tenant more quickly, and new companies that will handle the entire eviction process, making it easier for a landlord to file one in the first place.
Okay, again. Rules are always buckled up.
The legal arm of eviction does not end in court. If a tenant doesn't move out in 5 days, a landlord can file what's called a writ of possession and get a constable to physically remove you.
Okay, so what we know about this...
Teresa Stewart is a deputy with the Travis County Constable's Office in Southwest Austin. She's going to Sunset Valley to evict someone.
This is an older gentleman who is wheelchair-bound. We believe at this point that he has vacated the premises, but you never know. So we are going to go and do what's called a clearing of the apartment or a clearing of the residence.
We don't know much about who gets evicted. Courts don't track race, income, or the gender of tenants. But we do know where they're being evicted from. And with that, we can make guesses about who evictions affect the most. Half of last year's evictions were filed in just 6 Travis County zip codes, covering a large portion of North Austin, from Wells Branch to Windsor Hill, and several neighborhoods in Southeast Austin, East Riverside, and Montopolis. Families in these neighborhoods, on average, earn around $44,000 a year, and many of these residents are Hispanic. Even though Stewart believes the man she's about to evict has already left, she and another deputy still come to the door, guns drawn.
Police!
Constable's office!
Please?
Constable's office!
Their intel was right. No one's home. But the place looks like someone just left to run an errand. All the furniture is still there. Books, photos. There's a pamphlet on coping with death. And a running fish tank. The deputies rifle through drawers and cabinets, collecting any illegal substances.
If there's drugs that do belong to the individual... we'll leave them inside of the unit, and they will have 24 hours in which to come and get their belongings.
The rest of the tenant's things, a wicker TV stand, kitchen table chairs, his bed, are carried out to the curb by movers. Again, the tenant will have 24 hours to claim his things. Having a constable force a tenant out, what are called kickouts, doesn't happen in every case. In one part of Travis County, 2 out of every 5 evictions required a kickout. Back in the car, we head out to serve someone eviction papers. Deputy Stewart tells me how these usually go.
We try to ask them what their circumstances are. Are they out of work? Did they just forget to pay their rent? Did they have some sort of specific circumstance that came up? And have they communicated with the apartment complex or their landlord? We've found more often than not that communication is key. In these writ of executions, people feel like whenever they're embarrassed. They're embarrassed when they can't pay the rent. And rather than deal with it, they just keep hoping that they can come up with the rent or they can find a way. And you'll hear that phrase a lot. I was hoping I could find a way.
Audrey McGlynn Shee, KUT News.
About 70 million people worldwide stutter, and experts say 4 factors contribute to the development of stuttering: child development, neurophysiology, family dynamics, and genetics. But just a handful of clinicians in the U.S. offer treatment for stuttering. As KUT's Dalia Jones reports, one program at UT Austin is trying to fight those odds at summer camp.
It's noisy, like any other summer camp. There's horsing around.
Yeah, record your voice with a microphone.
I can't even hear you.
There's jokes.
What is the strongest creature in the sea?
What?
muscle.
There's even music. But at this camp, it's not how you say it, it's what you say.
My name is Cade, and what I wanted to share about stuttering is don't finish other people's sentences while they're stuttering.
This is camp.
Dream, speak, live. Okay, so we're going to
It's a week-long intensive therapy program at the Lang Stuttering Institute at the University of Texas. The program is the brainchild of Dr. Courtney Bird. She's the founding director of the institute and the camp. She began at UT as a postdoctoral researcher in 2004. During her research, she found that there was a limited number of specialists who could provide assessments or treatment for stuttering in Texas.
There's just a general lack of knowledge as to what to do with someone who stutters, and far too often people focus on just the observable behaviors.
So when UT got a $3 million gift, Bird jumped at the chance to help lead the Lang Institute. It's the only specialized research center in the nation that provides free stuttering treatment to adults and children. The treatment focuses on communication effectiveness, communication attitude, and social peer relationships. 3 years ago, Bird began offering the same treatment at a camp for students from all over the world.
That program has really taken off.
About 60 students between the ages of 4 and 17 participate in the program each year. The free camp has a waiting list of about 300 people who are picked at random. 14-year-old Royal Cumby was once a camper himself. Now he's a junior counselor.
It's amazing, first of all, and it's kind of like a safe place.
Cumby began stuttering treatment when he was 3 years old and continues to get treatment at the Lang Institute. Boys are 2 to 3 times more likely to be affected by stuttering, according to the National Institute on Deafness and Other Communication Disorders. Cumby says this safe space encouraged him to be comfortable with his stutter, but he also realized that people who stutter can be effective communicators. He says he's learned skills like disclosing.
It's where you introduce yourself. Hi, my name is Royal, and I have a stutter, and you may hear me repeat some words, so if you don't understand, please ask me to repeat, and that's really helped me.
Cumby says he wants to be a speech and language pathologist himself one day.
Embrace what you have, because not many people have it, and you're you, and you're special, and you need to teach other people about it and get them educated.
And Cumby is doing that by teaching other kids, like 11-year-old Jack Metters. He came to this week's camp from South Carolina.
You can get it away from the bullies who bully you because of your stutter, because everyone here knows how it feels.
Metters says being around other kids that stutter has also helped him understand his own value.
I think there's nothing wrong with me. It's a gift.
And that gift is usually not addressed in a productive manner, says Mary O'Dwyer. She's a speech and language pathologist who teaches at Trinity College Dublin in Ireland. She's also part of a European group that partnered with the Lang Institute to expand outreach for those who stutter. O'Dwyer says the challenges faced by those who stutter are universal.
There's just such a stigma around stuttering that people don't talk about it. Parents don't talk to their children about something that is terrifying their child. It's just hard to fathom.
O'Dwyer says this can also be hard for scientists who study the condition to fathom.
The real experts are the people who stutter, even if they're 4 years of age. You know, they really are the experts, like Royal here. Yeah, they really are the people who know. And we haven't listened to them enough. But now and now, I think more and more, we are bringing their voice into research.
Camp Dream Speak Live was hosted in Belgium for the first time earlier this year. It'll be expanded to Portugal and Ireland next year. But the Lang Institute's Courtney Bird says the camp, which is funded through donations, has a growing waiting list.
It takes an average of a year to have access to our everyday services. So it's exciting, but it's also daunting, and it's something that certainly stays with me at night.
Bird says they're always encouraging volunteers to help with the camp and the Lang Institute's other programs. Royal Cumby says he plans to continue being a counselor so he can keep sharing the message of camp.
Everyone's supposed to dream big, but live. I mean, like, live your life out. Don't be afraid, and speak. Everyone needs to speak, and with your stutter, don't be afraid to speak, even if you have one.
Dalia Jones, KUT News.
Well, you may have been doing some traveling this holiday season, and if that took you through Austin Bergstrom International Airport, you ever look down at the floor in front of the baggage claim? There's a map made of terrazzo tile, represents our city. Not quite as it is today, though, and when a listener noticed, she wrote to our AT Explained project to ask what it meant. As KUT's Mose Bouchel tells us, it started with some strange street names and got weirder from there.
Airports are busy places. Some people are rushing to their flights. Other people just landed. They're trying to get home. Who has the time to look at the public art? Well, meet Arcelia Hernandez.
So we had arrived.
She says it was her kids who pointed out the terrazzo map installed in the floor of the baggage claim.
I wouldn't have noticed it, but you know, children are closer to the ground and they're always reading their environment.
It's a big map, downtown Austin.
We began to read the map, just for fun.
First glance, it looks like a pretty faithful representation, except for the street names.
And then I noticed the misspellings.
They're all wrong.
Here's San Jacinto, and so it has San Han Cinto.
With an extra N.
Here's Brazos.
With two S's instead of a Z.
Here's La Vaca.
There's a B where there should be a V.
Here's Guadalupe.
Spelled the way some people still pronounce it in town.
Guada and L-O-U-P, Guadalupe.
Hernandez is a bilingual ed professor. This one really bothered her.
And so to have Guadalupe, which is like a pretty important name historically, to be misspelled, I don't know. I find this disturbing.
All right, let's keep looking because there's actually more here.
Oh, really?
Closely. Yeah. Look closely at Nueces.
Oh, my goodness.
It's got an extra E in it.
See, I totally missed that. Nueces? Okay, so what happened here? What is this about?
Take a close look at Sabine.
Sabine with the E at the end?
Look at the end.
Oh, my dear. Sabine?
Sabine.
Okay, so what happened here, Mouse?
Well, it's an old story and not always a happy one.
You can imagine him seething or certainly feeling jealous.
But we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. I
mean, should we get to the rest of that story?
Let's go back to the map for a second. Then. Turns out the map on the Austin airport floor is a recreation of the first map ever drawn of Austin. It was commissioned in 1839 before Texas was part of the U.S. President Maribou Lamar chose this place to be the capital of the new Republic of Texas.
Lamar picked a man named Edwin Waller to come up here and build this place.
By the way, this is Jeffrey Kerr. He's a local historian and author. He says Waller brought a team of 200 men, both free and enslaved. They had about 5 months to build a city from scratch.
The first thing he had to do, of course, was lay out the streets. They decided immediately to put the city between the two main creeks, which were Waller Creek and Shoal Creek.
So he got to name a creek after himself.
I don't know if he did that himself, but somehow he ended up with that.
But the important guy here isn't Waller. It was a surveyor on Waller's team named L.J. Pillier. He's the guy who drew the first Austin map. Who was he?
Well, he might have been from New Orleans.
He's referred to in letters as a Creole.
Pillier first came to Houston,
where he got into some financial trouble.
He went bankrupt there, and a couple of boats that he owned that were on the bayou were seized by the local sheriff in 1839. This was at about the same time that he was up here in Austin laying out the city streets.
Drawing the map of Austin was really important work. Back then, Texas had no money, but a lot of land. The government needed the map to sell lots in Austin to fund itself. Not everyone liked the idea. Sam Houston hated it.
And that was one of Houston's criticisms, was this is just a massive scam for a lot of people to make money on real estate deals, which it kind of was.
They named the east-west streets after Texas trees. They were later changed to numbers. And the north-south streets after Texas rivers, like they are today. Except on the Pillier map, they're spelled differently. Many, just like they are on the floor of the airport.
Here's Brazos.
It's spelled B-R-A-S-S-O-S on Pillier's map.
And here you have it with two S's. Here's La Vaca.
Which is spelled on the original map from Pillier as La Vaca, L-A-B-A-C-A.
And in Spanish, B and V, there's no sound of the V.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
But then there's Guadalupe. Nothing like the Spanish.
That one's kind of an important one.
That one I don't really know. All I can say is that spelling was very fluid back then.
But there is a reason he spelled it that way.
Guadalupe. Oh, yes. So they had the... Is that an O-U?
Yeah.
Should be an OU. Looks like an E.
This is Lars Henricks. He's a linguist at UT Austin, and he runs the Texas English Linguistics Lab.
Yeah, we study everything about Texas language.
He says the reason it's spelled Guadalupe with an L-O-U-P is simple. It's the way Anglos said the word. At the risk of oversimplifying the science here, it was easier for them. So Pillier, who seemed to spell some other streets phonetically, spelled Guadalupe as the city founders spoke it, and as a lot of people still do. And that means when you hear people say Guadalupe in Austin, well, they're butchering the Spanish, but they're also staying true to the way Pillier named the street on the first ever Austin map.
Maybe to say, yeah, the Anglos are doing it too. I don't know. Yeah. We cannot know.
No.
Somebody should have asked him.
But Pillier didn't stick around long enough to ask.
Next came selling the lots off. I mean, this is how the government was going to raise money to actually pay for everything that they were doing.
Here's Jeffrey Kerr again. He says, on August 1st, 1839, Austin's founders held an auction to sell the land. Real estate speculation.
Yeah.
We hear about it in Austin today, and it's been with us since the beginning.
It's one way of looking at it.
It happened under two big oak trees that still stand in Republic Square downtown.
You know, most of the people involved in building Austin participated and bought something. The auctioneer, for example, bought a couple lots.
He also made about $9,000 commission.
Some of the other surveyors bought lots. Most of the politicians that are going to be here bought lots.
But one person didn't.
Pillier didn't buy anything. And I think the reason is, as I pointed out, he was bankrupt. He didn't have any money.
If you remember, his boats had been seized to pay debts back in Houston.
You can imagine him seething or certainly feeling jealous. That would be a normal emotion as he's watching all these people who were buying lots left and right, and he's the guy that drew the map, and he couldn't buy anything.
A short time later, the auctioneer realized he was missing over $3,000 of his commission.
They traced it back to Pillier. They caught him with the money. They held an impromptu kangaroo court, convicted him, and then flogged him, and then drove him out of town. So within a short period of time after drawing this beautiful plat of Austin, Pillier was leaving town in disgrace.
Kerr thinks Pillier likely made it back to New Orleans, where he found success as a surveyor. That's the end of his story here, but it's not the end of ours.
So here's San Jacinto.
You see, some of the misspellings on the map of the airport don't match Pillier's original spellings.
And so it has San Jacinto.
Look closely at Nueces.
See, I totally missed that. Nueces? Sabinf?
Sabinf.
Okay, so what happened here, Mo?
Yeah, I'm surprised it's taken this many years to come up.
This is Jerry Ludwig. He lives in Houston now, but he was one of the men who designed and installed the Terrazzo map at the airport in 1999.
It was a big project for us at the time.
He says he had to clear the plans for the map with the city. And when he got the design back, the street names had been changed.
And when I seen that, I called him. I was like, you know, what is this? you know, because much like everybody else that looks at it that notices it goes, that's wrong.
The city explained this is how the street names appeared in the original 1839 map.
And, you know, my first question was, well, who's around from 1839 to know this?
But he says the city was insistent. So he laid the tiles exactly as they were spelled on the design he had been given.
Oh, yes. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Because it was really, really, really went over and back over so many times by so many different people.
The errors were caught after the job was done. In a short news report in 1999, the Austin Chronicle talked to Janet Siebert, the airport's cultural coordinator, about it. I tried to interview her, but the city's cultural arts division wouldn't let me. In the Chronicle story, she said the misspellings were going to be fixed, but almost 20 years later, they haven't been, and they probably won't be.
Yeah, that's the great thing about Terrazzo.
It lasts a long, long time. Mose Bushell, KUT News.
South by Southwest is less than 3 months away now, and every year there are always new people that come to the festival. KUT's Jimmy Moss found a pair of South by Southwest newbies to give us a fresh perspective on its opening day. His parents.
My name is James Moss, and I am the father of Jimmy Moss. Who's he? No. Okay.
My name is Regina Moss, and I'm your mother.
Now, it should be said that this was my dad's idea, which is why the day started about as far away as you can be from South by Southwest at one of his favorite restaurants.
We are eating at Budrucker's on Slaughter Lane.
So they're keeping it real casual about when they plan to arrive downtown, which could take a while.
Guess I have to get it. Probably go down Mopac to 35th or somewhere in there.
No worries. After some quick rerouting and armed with two voice memo apps, my parents waded into downtown to file this audio diary.
We're at 8th Street and Red River. Still lots of traffic. Trying to find a place to park. There doesn't seem to be very many signs, so if you're new to this, it's a little hard to figure out where things are. It's kind of like you've got to be in the know, and if you're not, then you kind of get lost.
Milo, I would like to tell you that it's a little early for some of the acts to show up and displays because they're still constructing their booths and activity around their event, so maybe today wouldn't be a good day to go walking around, see everything, but we're having a good time just observing how people are and what's going on.
We've walked all around, down from San Jacinto to 6th to 4th Street and back to 6th. Music everywhere. Saxophone players everywhere. We have explored the food effect, seeing how farming has changed and dairy farming has changed and what it's doing to feed the hungry. 1 in 6 children go hungry in our nation. Very sad.
I've just caught up with my parents. Your initial thoughts, Dad?
It's lousy, no. I'm just kidding. It's an interesting place to visit. Since we don't live here, I think we would probably come back sometime when we have skates. But walking around is a lot.
Mom, your thoughts?
There's lots of people, lots of things to see. One of the things that I got tickled at is that all the bars wanted us to come in and have margarita and be able to be in bed by 9 o'clock. So I'm insinuating that we're old, I guess. I don't know.
Maybe next time you'll come and try to game plan for less walking?
Yes. It would have to be something like that, I think, for me. Because there's not enough places to sit down, you know, and rest. For old people, I guess.
Last thing, did you enjoy taking part in a report here on South by Southwest? This is the most I've heard you talk in years.
I know it. That's it. That's the problem. I talk so much. And I get tired.
Well, I'll let you get back to the house.
Okay.
For Jim Moss and Regina Moss.
He's going to talk to you and ask you some questions. You're going to talk to him there. Okay.
Which one's which? Hello.
There you go.
Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
We've been doing AT Explained all year long. If you haven't heard about it, we take a question from a listener about Austin, the people, the places, the culture, and we investigate the story behind it. And a lot of those questions have to do with how Austin is changing and what gets left behind. This installment is something along those lines. KUT's Matt Largy reports.
The story got me thinking a lot about progress and history, and particularly reminded me of this old kid's book. It's called The Little House. It was written back in the 1940s.
Once upon a time, there was a little house way out in the country. She was a pretty little house, and she was strong and well-built. The man who built her so well said, "This little house shall never be sold for gold or silver, and she will live to see our great-great-grandchildren's great-great-grandchildren living in her." The little house was very happy as she sat on the hill and watched the countryside around her. Way off in the distance, she could see the lights of the city. The little house was curious about the city and wondered what it would be like to live there.
So here's what caught the attention of our question askers.
I was driving down 183 right past the airport.
Right where Highway 71 splits.
And there's this mound of dirt.
It's on the left.
Right beside that mound of dirt in between both the south and north sides of 183.
I remember doing a double take like, that's a cemetery.
There's this little tiny cemetery.
This tiny cemetery.
In the median between the highways.
That was Lee Bolton, Pacheska Marrero, and Emily Bain. They all asked about the story behind this little cemetery for ET Explained. Who's there? Why is it still there? And what will become of it? All right, I'm coming west on 71, and we're looking for this little cemetery. There are cranes and dump trucks and bulldozers everywhere. They're working on new ramps for this intersection between Highway 71 and 183. All right, whoa. Okay, there it is. In the middle of the road there, there's a couple of mesquite trees and some gravestones. Now I just have to figure out how the heck I'm going to get to it. Going to have to turn around. I parked the car on the side of the road across 183. Going to have to cross 183 on foot here in a second. That's going to be awesome. Fortunately, it's just a little two-lane section of it. Wait, there's nothing coming. I'm going. Okay. Got across. Up close, the whole thing is overgrown. You can barely see the gravestones. The cemetery is surrounded by a rusted chain-link fence, and then another fence around that. A couple sad-looking mesquite trees droop over the burial ground. There's a plaque here. It says, Davidson Little Page Cemetery, established 1856. 1856. This place has been here for 162 years. The city of Austin was only about 30 years old when the first person was buried here. The landscape back then would have been dramatically different. It was a cotton plantation. Now, massive hills of dirt and old construction equipment loom over the cemetery. So, our question askers wonder,
are they building over it? Are they building around it? Are they going to move it?
First, let's start with who they were.
Should I go through the graves for you?
Yeah, like, please.
This is Nancy Beam Pexa. She lives in Minnesota, but some of the people buried in the Davidson Little Page Cemetery are her ancestors.
Okay, Martha Elizabeth, wife of A.M. Davidson, and she was born 1816. She died 1864.
Nancy's done a ton of research on her family. Martha Elizabeth Davidson was her great-great-great-grandmother. She lived to 48.
Two of their children died young. So those are two of the graves there. So you've got the mother with two children, James and Lavinia.
James A. Davidson and Lavinia Davidson Campbell died at 20 and 23 years old.
Martha Knight Littlepage, and she was born 30th of October, 1837, Tennessee, and she died about the 10th of March, 1868.
She was 30 years old.
The other person that's buried there is Susan Littlepage, born April 23rd, 1804. Died January 21st, 1870.
She lived to 65, but we don't know much about them beyond when they were born and when they died, who they married, and who their kids were.
Really, you should be talking to, because he lives in Austin, is James White. He owns the Broken Spoke.
Oh, really? Oh, okay, yeah.
Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
This is James White.
Okay, I'm James White, and
like Nancy said, he and his wife own the Broken Spoke, the iconic dance hall in South Austin.
What do you want me to say? This is Annetta White.
But before we get to the Whites, let's go back a ways.
One day, the little house was surprised to see a horseless carriage coming down the winding country road. Pretty soon, along came a steam shovel and dug a road through the hill covered with daisies. Now the little house watched the trucks and the automobiles going back and forth to the city. Everyone and everything moved much faster than before.
As the years passed, things changed around the Davidson Little Page Cemetery. Roads were built, an Air Force base. The cotton plantation out here was chopped into ever smaller pieces. In the 1950s, a crew surveying for a new highway to Bastrop found the cemetery. The headstones fallen over, the grass and trees surrounding it overgrown. They could have dug it up, carted what was left of the bodies off somewhere else, but they didn't. They steered the highway around the little cemetery, fixed up the headstones, cleared away the weeds. They put up a chain-link fence to protect it. but they couldn't find anyone to claim it. Which brings me back to these folks.
I'm Annetta White.
I'm James White.
I'm married to James for 51 years.
And the rest of this story starts with kind of a mystery.
You know, we started getting into genealogy in 1969, and I've been hearing family stories about my family forever since I was a little kid, you know, and I kind of knew about Grampy Campbell, who was John Eaton Campbell.
That's John Eaton Campbell of Campbell's Hole, the swimming spot on Barton Creek.
And I never really heard that much about his wife, whose last name was Davidson.
Maiden name was Davidson.
Yeah, the maiden name was Davidson. Anyway, you know, we got to thinking about, you know, we knew where Grampy was buried over there at the Masonic Cemetery off of South Congress, but we started asking the family members, says, you know, where was his wife buried? And nobody knew anything about it.
Everybody we talked to said, oh, she just wandered off one day. I said, she didn't wander off.
So they kept looking. This was sometime in the 1980s. They're not sure exactly when.
His dad came to town from California, and he and I went to the Austin History Library, and we asked to see all the cemeteries. And we started looking for her name.
They dug through the records, spent hours at it. Finally, they found her, Lavinia Davidson Campbell.
You know, I just can't even tell you the feeling when we finally found that. It's, when you do genealogy, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. And you're so thrilled when you find another piece that fits.
I always kind of figure, you know, you should know where you came from. Maybe it'll help you figure out where you're going, you know. It's just some little simple thing. It's a clue of some sort.
So Annetta and James's dad figured out where Lavinia was buried, in the Davidson Little Page Cemetery.
Then we went home, got James. We all went out there and kind of found it together.
Out to the little cemetery in the country.
I remember very vividly as a sitter, you know. When I finally, you know, got there, it made everything real. You know, it's like, this is my great-great-grandmother. And it was just a fulfillment. I mean, all of a sudden, you're there, you know, and it's like finding gold, you know, or something. If you haven't been out there digging in the dirt for a long time, you know, man, I've hit the mother load, you know.
They'd learn more about Lavinia Campbell as time went on. They'd find new clues about the little cemetery and who's buried there, next to Lavinia's death date in a family Bible.
November the 17th, 1857.
A note that someone else died that day, too.
Little Angel brother died. That's the baby that they lost.
Yeah, evidently they never named the baby, I guess.
I think when they died, just after being born, a lot of times they didn't name them.
Lavinia died in childbirth, which was not uncommon in those days, and they think she and the baby are buried together at the Davidson Little Page Cemetery. Later, they'd bring Nancy, James's cousin, to see the cemetery.
It was almost spiritual. I said a prayer and thought, I wondered how many people never knew that they were there all these years.
Now, the little house only saw the sun at noon and didn't see the moon or the stars at all because the lights of the city were too bright.
So, we know that back in the 1950s, highway planners saved the cemetery. But now there's a whole lot of construction going on here again as a new section of 183 gets built. Flyovers will go up on either side of the cemetery. So, what happens now?
Most of what we're doing right now does not come anywhere close to the cemetery.
This is Steve Pastelnik. He's with the Central Texas Regional Mobility Authority, the agency doing all the road construction around the cemetery.
At this point, I would assume it'll be left there for some time to come.
The highway will rise around the cemetery for now, casting shadows on the graves.
I hope they leave it just like it is, and when they get through with all the construction out there, I hope they put a real nice fence, a fence that is deserving of them.
I can't help but notice the parallels between James's ancestors' resting place and his business, the legendary honky-tonk on South Lamar he started more than 50 years ago, the progress around it, the shadows cast by the buildings that now loom over it.
I got all this modernistic apartments all around me. I got a busy South Lamar. It's never been that busy in my lifetime. And it's got all the hustle and bustle of Austin. But once you walk in the Broken Spoke, it's kind of like a two-step back in time, and you're walking into a historical place.
And it's kind of the same with the cemetery. At night, when the traffic calms down and the airplanes overhead get a little less frequent, you can almost take that step back in time. Close your eyes and feel a little, just a little, of what it might have been like when these folks were laid to rest out here so many years ago. I like to imagine it that way. Just like at the end of the book, The Little House, when they move her back out to the country.
The stars twinkled above her. A new moon was coming up. It was spring, and all was quiet and peaceful in the country.
That is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of 2018. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. You can email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org. Or you can ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Happy New Year. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast in 2018. And I hope you continue to listen in 2019. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. And then,